This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is iFanboy Pick of the Week number 871, brought to you by Macroverse. Check out their new comic book series, Darkland, on Webtoons and on the Macroverse app. And iFanboy listeners just like you.
Sun on your skull, back to the light. Pack your bags, take up your sight, cause this world grows in my clothes, bro.
My name is Ryan Haupt, and this is my co-host, Josh Flanagan.
I'm the co-host? Wait, how can I be your co-host? You know what? I'm cool with it. You drive the boat.
I'm just reading the script that was sent to me, and welcome to Diddly Squad Diddly Cast, the only show where we talk about Clarkson's Farm. Season 2 just ended. Josh, what do you think?
I'm glad that he got it done, but I'm curious to hear from the other side of the people who really didn't like him. Were they just assholes, or is there more to it?
It's a fascinating question, and that's what we're going to be diving into in this week's episode, but it's also, we're co-podcasting, we're doing two podcasts at once, because this is also iFanboy Pick of the Week, episode 871. Every week, one of us picks the book they liked best from their stack of comics, and we call that the Pick of the Week. Pow!
Boom.
And then the Marc Maron joke that comes after saying pow.
Well, I forgot about that.
I know, right? We are going to talk about that book and other books from the week, the patron pick, and we will answer some listener mail if we have time. I sure hope we do. Here is your spoiler warning. Exercise some caution. Use just good old-fashioned common sense. This week, Josh had the pick.
It was a Batman week.
It was also a good week.
It was a pretty good week. I'm not going to tell you that I was like my pick was immediate, but like I really enjoyed my comics, and I noticed that many of the books that I enjoyed happened to be Batman books. Also, I was reading Kingdom Come because that's going to be our next book explode.
Connor's not here? Because he claims the Batman books are a mess and we didn't want him here on a week where Batman was good?
Well, I was like, I'm really bummed you're not going to be here this week because I think you would have really enjoyed yourself. But you know, he's on the world's longest, most involved business trip. He's never coming home again, as far as I can tell. He's going to be recovering next week when we do this show. So the pick of the week is Batman, One Bad Day, I looked that up. Ra's al Ghul number one. This is the last of the One Bad Day series, as far as I understand. Is written by Tom Taylor with art by Ivan Reis. Inks by Danny Mickey, who's normally a name you associate with John Romita Jr. Brad Anderson on colors and Wes Abbott on letters. But when I first wrote that, I was looking at Brad Anderson and I wrote Wes Anderson. But he does not letter comics. And if he did, there'd be far more twee than these. Anyway.
And also, I think the color, I think Wes Anderson would be a colorist more than a letter. I guess he could be a letter or two. He's a font guy. It's hard to say.
Yeah, no, totally being the typography. I mean, like, this doesn't fit with what we're doing at all. I don't think I've read all of the One Bad Days, but I have reluctantly enjoyed the ones I have. I didn't think I would, but I mean, the first one was the Tom King one with Riddler. I read a couple of those that I can't even remember, but here we are. So why are we talking about Ra's al Ghul and Tom Taylor? Well, it's easy enough to know why you would like something with Tom Taylor. And I think Ivan Reis was actually perfect for this. It's not a name that you normally see next to Tom Taylor. It's just not the style that usually goes along with him. But for this sort of, to me, this is like a throwback 70s, 80s sort of looking tale. I really like that Ra's al Ghul from that time when he was very gray. He was an environmentalist.
Yeah,
and an extremist, but he wasn't a villain in exactly the same. It wasn't like, look at the bad guy. It was a different thing. And so when you go back to, oh, what's the name of that? That the one where Batman sleeps with
Talia. Demon's Head?
Yeah, there you go. Demon's Head. Something like that. That's that famous story. I think it's Mike O'Barr. And that is my favorite Ra's al Ghul, because he's sort of a demented grandfather that Batman kind of has to put up with. And he's all over the place in modern stuff, I think. But this to me is like, that's like roots Ra's al Ghul. And this to me harkens back to that. Even though this takes place in what is, I feel so self-conscious talking about Batman stuff without Connor here to check me.
Well, but it's Damian Wayne Robin. Yeah. So it's got to be close enough to the modern era that that's the current Robin, and clearly a Robin who's been working with Bruce for some time.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a little bit of flashback. We're spending more. I don't believe this is in continuity. I don't think any of them are. We're spending a little bit of time seeing where Ra's al Ghul came from when he was young, and he had a friend who was a wolf, and then the wolf dies eventually. And like, that's the last of that kind of wolf.
Dude, I'm not going to lie. I legit teared up.
Yeah.
Like Tom Taylor, I was a little mad at Tom Taylor for like making me cry over a Batman book, because I don't think a tear fell, but I was choking him back with that scene with him and the wolf.
I mean, he does terrible stuff in here, but it's very easy to see his side of things.
Yeah.
You know, he basically, the idea is that he put this massive, ridiculous comic book plan into effect over the course of like a decade or more, where he had, I remember many, it was like 90 companies, we'll say 60,
30,
whatever.
I think it was 30.
Oh, it's 30? That makes it even so. And he had done all this planning and maneuvering to get people that he approved of in charge of these different companies, if only the people who were running them were to get knocked off. And so he kills them all. And you know, through various means of subterfuge, there can be no hints or whatever, or Batman will know. And so, of course, immediately Batman figures it out.
It's like Secession.
Yes.
It's the Brian Cox show.
Fuck off. and Batman shows up with Damian, and Damian's fully on the side of his dad. And then Ra's al Ghul kills him, Batman. And you're like, oh shit. And of course, you know, brings him back after everything's done. And the thing that got me, all of that was interesting. It was all fun. I think the art was perfect for what this story was, you know, like everything was just my favorite Ra's al Ghul outfit, you know, with the little buttons and the cape and the sort of, you know, turn of the century sort of style going on there. But they wake up Batman out of the Lazarus pit, because of course he's not going to die, and all the people have been killed, and like, well, what are you going to do about it? And they do the math, and Batman's like, all right, I'm not gonna do anything. And I was like, wow.
But it also ends with a shirtless sword fight in the snow between Batman and Ra's, and that to me is classic. That to me is what evokes that 70s 80s, like Batman's still wearing his cowl, but they're both shirtless and they both got swords. Also, did you notice that Ra's is willing to use the Lazarus pit fully nude, but Batman keeps the little briefs on?
Well, there was a controversy, so we don't want to take any risk of a Batman dick again, because that brings the whole line down.
Both Talia and Damian are willing to fully embrace their fathers where they're mostly naked and sopping wet. And I was just like, really? That's gross.
Well, at what age is that not okay? That's the question.
Well, Ra's is 700. So maybe, I would say 650 is
maybe
too old.
You come around the bend eventually. It's like, all right, I can hug him naked dick and all. It's fine.
There's a joke to be made there that I'm not going to make.
I got to say, I just flipping through this right now, the art reminds me of Neil Adams in
the
70s. There's a bit where
the expressiveness of the faces.
Right.
Yeah.
And it, like, he, when Ra's runs Batman through with a sword, which, by the way, that drawing doesn't look right anatomy wise. His hand's way too far over. Anyway, the next page though is Robin screaming through his mask and without tape. And that to me, that's like, that looks like the best of a Neil Adams type of shot, which gives this whole thing its flavor. It always makes me think of, for me, a real touchstone was I Got the Greatest Joker Stories Ever Told. And that included like a Joker story from every era, or, you know, several from each one. And the 70s and late 60s always stuck with me. And those are in my mind. That's the coolest looking of Batman stuff. And that page right there brought me directly to that.
Also, something I think that I think I hear you comment on a fair bit, because you have, you know, children who are aging into themselves, like watching Damian put on the cowl and have it not quite fit. Uh-huh. And I thought that was drawn really well. Like, it's got to be, I imagine as a draftsman, it has to be difficult to have a character put something on that doesn't fit.
That is awesome, though. And he pulls the cowl on that's too big. Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. I mean, everything is sort of like, there's tears running down his face. There is, you know, it's a ton of melodrama. It's the melodrama for this that really sold it. And then the sort of last bit, which is that, you know, Batman's got a code. Batman never breaks his code or whatever, but he kind of acquiesces a little at the end. And I thought,
it's hard,
wow,
not to. How do you not agree with Roz on this issue? Like the lion poacher at the very end, where he's like, I'm doing this. I'm talking to you through your walkie talkie because in your last moments, I want you to know the world will go on without you. And I'm like, fuck yeah, get him. Like, get that poacher. Like, I actually think he probably might have been legally hunting those lions, but that's a whole other issue about how game parks in Africa are managed. Right. But still, like, trophy hunting in general is not something I'm a huge fan of. And it seems to also, I'm not a fan of it in general. And it also seems to be done by the biggest douchebags on the planet. So, you know, it's like, it's really hard not to root for Raz in this one and be
it
like,
is.
Yeah. He brought Batman. He brought Bruce back. Bruce can continue his quest. He even, you know, and he called Bruce's bluff on whether or not killing these 30 people who are doing irreparable harm to the planet was really not worth pursuing.
It's just, yeah, it was kind of a perfect little story. It wasn't like so far out of, you know, it was, you know, you could have read this story in a Batman book, but it's out of continuity. I think that works a little better. It just, you know, it was just a really nice little comic book experience that sort of had a little from every era.
And it's a puppy at the end.
That's nice.
Because we like dogs.
Well, sure. It's the big thing. So that is the pick of the week. I would say that the runner-up was probably Batman Superman : World's Finest number 13, which has a delightful cover. If we're going to talk about going back to an earlier time.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, Connor's like a big Dan Mora fan.
I'm a huge Dan Mora fan.
And I really like him, but as this series goes on, I like him even more.
Yeah, the cover is, you know, Batman Superman running one direction across the page with a bunch of monuments in the background, you know, and then it's got Metamorpho doing like the Roadrunner Wile E. Coyote spinny leg move in a non-urban environment. And
It's just such a graphic cover, and it looks like, I don't ever notice covers anymore, but this looks it looks like a cover from a different time, and there's so much iconography that we don't use anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, comic book iconography is amazing. And because comics is such a weird industry where like simultaneously love the past and want to get away from it as much as possible to try to do new things. And when you've got, you know, Mark Waid who revels in it and can lean into it like this, and then Dan Mora, who is perfectly adapted to sort of do a little of everything, it's just a really nice, it comes together really well. It also happens that with my son, we had been watching, we're slow because it's hard to get him off of YouTube, we've been watching through the Justice League show.
Yeah,
we're into the second season now, but I can't remember if it's the beginning of the second season or the end of the first season is the Metamorpho story.
Now, is it weird at the end of the Justice League episodes when Superman asks you to smash that subscribe button and click the bell?
Sorry,
I didn't mean to trigger you.
We recently watched like the Metamorpho episode.
Good episode.
With all these characters in them. And like, so when, is it Stag? I think it's,
yes,
Stag. When Stag shows up, like, I was like, he's drawn just like the cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was great. That's like it looks like a Kirby villain.
Oh yeah, like, it's an iconic look. Yeah,
yeah.
Well, it looks kind of like Kirby if he were a villain.
Right. That it does. Also, that's true. I did think that. I was like, is that? I think that's a little Jack
it's,
there.
It's sort of like if Kirby was Norman Osborn. That's sort of the vibe.
And I love Metamorpho. He's one of my favorite characters who never shows up in anything.
He's got to be a hard character to write because he can do so much, but he's also so weird.
Well, what's funny is that like he's Indiana Jones apparently. Mm. But he sounds like he's like a mook from Brooklyn in the 30s.
Yeah.
which those things don't really seem to go together, but I like it because he's really just a bunch of everything all together. I mean, and you know, the thing is,
the American Museum of Natural History is in New York.
It is. It's true. But he would have that mid-Atlantic accent instead. So anyway, there's a dual thing going on here where they're trying to figure out who killed Stagg, Batman and Superman.
Locked door mystery. And yeah. Yeah.
And super, and it's like when you look at it, it's, oh, they're clearly trying to lead us to the fact that Metamorpho killed him. And Superman goes, hey, Jimmy, why don't you, or when he's Clark, he says, why don't you come along with me, work this angle, which is bullshit because he's making Jimmy do his job while he does something else. But sure. Whatever. And then Jimmy, you know, locks in.
Clark can't quiet quitting at the Daily Planet. Yeah.
Jimmy locks in and does an amazing job and comes to the conclusion, which Perry has to agree with because it makes the most sense, that it was, in fact, Bruce Wayne who was arrested for killing Stagg.
Which doesn't totally make sense to me yet.
Well, that's because you know all about him.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously I know Bruce Wayne's no murderer, but like, yeah, I guess if Bruce was off Batmaning at the time of the murder, then maybe he doesn't have an alibi or whatever. Yeah, I mean, it sets up an interesting premise, and I'll be curious to see where it goes. I mean, I'm gonna keep reading this book for sure.
But I also really like the scene where Jimmy and Perry are talking about it to Clark, And Clark's like, he can't have done this. And Perry's like, well, tell me why.
Well, but also they're keeping it. You don't know they're talking about Bruce. You still think they're talking about Metamorpho.
Yes, but even saying that and then going back and seeing what it is, I like it even better because it's Clark can't do anything.
Yeah.
Because they took his secret identity and put it back because it's so much better. And if this was that stupid not having secret identity thing, it would have been ruined.
But no, I mean, it's the I think some of the most powerful Superman moments in storytelling are the moments when his powers don't serve him at all.
Sure.
And he's trapped, you know, he's stuck against a situation where he can't do anything, mm-hmm. even with all the power that he has, because it you know, violates his yeah. code or his identity or whatever. So, yeah, it was great. I mean, super interesting.
It was good. It was, you know, it was just great. All I've come to. I mean, this was Connor's favorite series from the very beginning, and I, like, I enjoyed it, and I keep reading it, but
did you see what the other front page story was on the Planet?
No.
After Bruce Wayne arrested for Stagg murder?
Let's see.
Superman warns of smoking hazard.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, a little PSA.
Yeah, and he did. He warned Lois about that in the film.
I don't know if that's front page news, but
also, the newspaper's not shaped like that. Anyway, I really dug it. So there's two sort of Batman, at least Batman involved stories.
Bat Corner.
Yeah, very good time. And also, you know, out of continuity, they could just do their thing.
The next book we're going to talk about, Punisher number 10, story by Jason Alexander. They got punished, Jerry. It's Jason Aaron.
I don't know what's going on with me today.
A story by Jason Aaron, art by Jesus Saez and Paul Azaceta, colors by Matt Hollingsworth, and letters by Corey Pettit. One of the things I want to talk about this book, I've been enjoying this series. It has not worn us welcome yet. We're kind of in our second story arc at this point. He's since defeated Ares and has now like fully embodied this power set that he's gotten from the demon that controls the hand. But the one thing I want to talk about is, have you guys on the show ever discussed the trend that has emerged where you've got an artist for the main story and then all the flashbacks are a different artist? Because I actually think it's a fantastic trend.
I mean, it's not new. I think the first modern mainstream instances I can think of that were that there was a Iron Fist run by Ed Brubaker and Matt Fraction.
Aja.
And David Aja was on it, but the flashbacks were done by somebody
it was
else.
Spanish, so it should probably be Aja. But
yeah.
But I just think, and that book still feels like part of the modern era to me.
Yes, it does. But that was at least a decade ago.
10 plus years ago. I really like it as a device because it means that artists can stay better on schedule. It means that there's a really obvious visual signifier when the story switches time and place. And I really dig it. I dig getting to see two different excellent artists work on the same story in parallel. I think it's really cool.
One of the things I think is really cool about it, and this is probably somewhat happenstance and somewhat, I mean, you give credit for good editing or whatever, and possibly even the colorist, is how the styles are not the same. They are absolutely distinguishable from one another, but are complementary in this way. Because there's times where they do this, and I feel like Bendis used to do this a lot, where he'd bring other people in, and the art styles didn't complement each other.
Mm.
And, you know, if you look at what Matt Hollingsworth does between the two different styles, it does not look the same. I mean, like, the coloring style is different. It has texture and shadow, and is giving shape to things in the sort of current storyline.
Mm-hmm.
And it's much flatter and more graphic and abstract, I guess, in the past.
The past, he almost colors it to look like a Sean Phillips book more than a... Yeah, whereas
The two artists we're talking about are Jesus Saez, who has an enormous range. It's a guy whose name I see all the time, and I honestly doesn't get enough credit, I don't think, for his do-everything ability. And then the other bit is by Paul Azaceta, an artist who I love, was working on a lot of things for a while. In mainstream, and then did Kirkman book. They did a show of it on Showtime. It's about the guy.
Demon one?
Yes. I don't remember what it's called either. But he was over there for a long time. And from what I understand, Kirkman pays his artist pretty well. So he was loving that. And then they got the TV show. It was doing really well. And so, you know, he showed up here and I was like, oh, this is great, which seems like such a weird choice. But his stuff is the past actual sort of street level Frank Castle with his family, which is actually stuff I've never really seen in depth. I don't know if any of us has to sort of get this
there
story.
There was a book Connor and I talked about last time I was on the show that looked at some of that as well. But
from her point of view, though.
From Maria's point of view is the part that's super interesting about that for sure. I agree with that. And I also think... I don't think I picked up on it until more recently in the series, but like I feel like... it was talked about early in his career when Jason Aaron kind of came out of nowhere and blew us all away with things like The Other Side and the early issues of Scalped. But, you know, his uncle wrote Full Metal Jacket, the book that the novel or the movie was based off of. And like, I actually think we're getting some like cool, like Full Metal Jacket level storytelling about, you know, war and Frank and the relationship between men and war. And I don't know. I'm not saying that like he's aping his uncle's style or anything like that. I just think he's almost getting back to his roots on things like The Other Side in a way that I am enjoying and find very refreshing.
I think one of the magical tricks here is that it's very difficult to humanize the Punisher because if you make him sympathetic, you make him squishy, the whole thing falls apart. And there's a tightrope being walked here with these, like, he's a homicidal maniac. He's trying to do it for good.
He found what he thinks is a righteous outlet for that, whatever demon is inside him. But everyone else can see that it's still a really bad situation. I mean, it's still completely unacceptable to someone like Captain America. So the heroes will have to oppose him, even though... Similar to Ra's al Ghul, like his cause is righteous theoretically. Mm-hmm. He's killing other bad people, worse people than.
And
him,
who is he to judge? But you know.
But the thing that's new about this series that I don't think we've seen before is, you know, Maria has been brought back to life by the magic of the hand, and she's kind of hot for it. She's kind of into it.
Well, I think she had to accept it. The bullet hole still in her body is creepy.
I don't know. I mean, the way she was holding the gun that he initially gave her to teach her how to use it.
She's like, been into it. The Punisher.
I thought there was going to be a moment where she was going to kill herself because she's found the graves of her kids and all this other stuff. But like, so I actually was surprised by the turn it took, where it's like, oh, she's not going to kill herself. She's going to embrace Frank's mission.
There's definitely a thing in the past, in the flashbacks, that reminds me of there's a bit in Goodfellas where Karen is talking about Henry, and she's like, you know, I most girls, when as soon as they show the gun, they would run when he beats the guy across the street, hits him in the face 11 times. That's a thing I don't even have to look up. Hits him 11 times, you know, and she goes, I gotta admit, it turned me on. And that's what's going on in here a little bit.
Totally.
Like, she likes that power of him. She's scared. She's a normal person. She's, you know, but that's her protector. That's her, you know, and she has an innate trust and love in him. Anyway, like I said, I think it's a real tightrope because this could fall apart and be dumb at any minute. And one thing that I have to do is I have to ignore the fact that they're trying to say that this demonic force that lives in him is literal.
Yeah.
I'm choosing to see it as a big metaphor through the whole thing. And that makes it work for me.
But in the words of the characters from our favorite Star Wars movie, he flies now. They fly now.
Yeah. Well, whatever. You know, also, you know, and I have to constantly remember not to take things too. It's like, it's a comic book. Make it fucking silly.
Yeah, he'll go back to being good old street level Frank Castle matter. At some point.
He'll get his skull back and
he's not some sort of magical sorcerer supreme. Transition.
You know, it's a thing. Like, I don't like the Punisher, really.
But I'm enjoying the series, though.
Exactly. You know, it is a Jason Aaron that I recognize and enjoy.
There were sharks in a previous issue, I noticed, when a ship sank.
You know what? That only makes you love somebody more. Do you put sharks in as many comics as possible? Yes, I do.
Okay. No, that's a win for me. That's a win.
Totally.
I want Jason to do. I want him to do an entire miniseries on the USS Indiana. I want it.
It's a very long series of people just floating in the water.
It's also a pretty good pull on my part, I thought.
Yeah. I just started thinking about the scene.
I was going to say, I thought you were going to introduce the next book, but I realized I led you mentally astray.
I was trying to remember the day, like, because the Quint starts with, like, the June, the 7th, 1945, you know.
Got been, dead days, like an old
July,
days.
I think. Yes, Doctor Strange, number 427,
or
as it says on this cover, one. We have now survived the death of Doctor Strange, and then the last miniseries was the new Sorcerer Supreme, who is also of the name Strange. That would be his wife. And now he's back, and I think he's the Sorcerer Supreme again. She gave
of
him
Earth, the, and she's the Sorcerer Earth. Supreme of the Dark Dimension.
Right, okay.
This book almost lost me on page two, I'm not going to lie.
Okay.
Because he's like writing the sign, you know, he's like writing something in every other panel on the first page. And then on the second page, it implies that the thing he was writing was the doctor is in. Mm-hmm. And none of the marks he's making on the first page match what's on the second page.
The magic marks.
I don't like it.
I see what you're saying, but I had not noticed that.
It bothered me immediately. I almost couldn't move past it.
I, on the other hand, was thinking, well, this is an interesting change in art. And I thought, oh, it's Pascal Ferry.
Yay. That, I love Pascal Ferry.
It's a great name. And I think this is not entirely the style that you would associate with him immediately.
It's a much finer line than we're used to seeing from him.
Yeah. Like he moved to digital or something like that. But I really liked how, I don't even know what the word is I'm looking for. It's very delicate. It's very flowy. It's very, you know, it's ethereal. It's sort of overuse a term. And if you look at like Strange's face in every single panel is placid. He's just like, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's evocative of the Ditko era Strange while still feeling very modern.
Yeah, or at least unique to its own thing.
Which I mean as a compliment.
It's almost like a retro-modern thing, I guess. You know, it's been a long run of Doctor Strange, Stephen Strange sort of being, you know, in our lives after sort of nobody could put a handle on him, and I'm not tired of him yet.
And obviously, you know, they figured out a way to use him in the MCU, both, you know, in like relation to Tony Stark, but now functioning as the Tony Stark. So I think that's helped keep him in the comics, at least, you know, they always want to have a series going. So that's, I don't think we're not going to get a break from him until old Benny Cumberbatch is done with his run. Which I'm not mad at. These are good books.
So him and Clea has not always been involved. She's showed up, but she like became a character. She showed up for good for a while here. And they were
you a Clea guy prior to the, like, did you have any relationship with that character prior to the recent stuff that Jed McKay's done? Okay. I didn't either.
She had shown up at some point earlier than that. So I knew about her. There was some, maybe it was during Mark Waid's, like he went to hell or something like that. And she was there and he couldn't let her go. And goes down into hell and brings her back up. And if she turns around, she goes back. It's from the Sandman, but also Greek myth. It was a little like that, I think, in maybe the Mark Waid run, like way back, or possibly Jason Aaron, I forget. But no, not really. It wasn't a thing I really knew about. But sort of she keeps showing up and being more part of it. And now she's fully engaged in it. And what they're trying to show us here, it's interesting because the entire time she has been like, hey, she's doom-like. She's like, I'm the daughter of demons. I'm whatever, you know, like for where I come from, we kill everything or whatever. But they're in love with each other. And seemingly there's no conflict there up until this issue where there's a real bad dude. And she's like, I'm going to kill that fucker. And he's like, no, you can't. And then we are led to believe at the very end that somebody has killed that fucker. And we wonder, oh, is this going to be the strain on their marriage?
And then there's a backup story where it looks like the fucker was killed in a different way.
I will say the page where the fucker was killed, which is the last page of the main story, I don't believe it. I had to go back and forth. I don't think it was very clear what happened. Like, because
he kind of just explodes.
Well, not even him. His chair does.
Yeah.
And I was like, what are those blocks?
Well,
and
I mean, back Josh, if the chair you're sitting in explodes, you probably also explode.
No one wants to explode. That's what I say. And then, and this cannot be overstated, is that the backup story is drawn by Andy McDonald. And I love Andy McDonald, and I haven't seen him in years.
The backup story didn't do much for me, so I'm interested to hear that you had a good experience with it.
And then this weird, like, there's a strange old hippie character from the 70s who's clearly Alan Moore. And Alan Moore is trying to freak out everybody with his hallucinogenic drugs, which he's going to drop over, I guess, Birmingham in England.
Is that where Alan Moore's from?
He's from Northumberland, Northampton, I believe. I don't know where that is in relation to Birmingham. But he looks a lot like Alan Moore to me, and he's into freaking people out, and he's got the whole wizard hair going on. Whatever. Like, I don't really care about the story, although I thought it was funny that I was like, I'm pretty sure that's Alan Moore, but I love Andy McDonald. And that was enough for me. Jed McKay wrote it, so I was like, well, it must mean something that's worth something. A big floating ship.
Do you know, is Jed McKay a big Alan Moore guy?
I don't know. I don't know who works in modern comics who's about my age, you know, or around then, who isn't a big Alan Moore person.
I don't know Jed McKay as well as you might have known him.
I don't know him at all.
Well, get him on. You got a show where you talk to people.
Well, he's gotten my emails and has henceforth chosen not to respond to them.
How are you feeling about Luke Cage as mayor of New York City?
I don't need it.
It has yet to do anything that I think could be interesting with that premise. Like, there's no Luke Cage book coming out right now.
Is it like Luke Cage mayor? You know me. I love bureaucracy. I love politics or whatever.
Middle management, Luke Cage.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's kind of fun, but I don't think that's interesting for him. It's like a way that they can try to say how capable he is and how responsible and trustworthy he is and that he does his duty or whatever, but it's not adding anything to the character, I don't think. I want it to be over. Like, I don't hate it, but I'm like, I hope this is over soon. Which I also thought about the Kingpin is the mayor. It was too long.
Right. But I also, That at least, to me, I don't know, for whatever reason, that to me, like, I feel like I'm used to terrible people being in politics and running things. So like that to me felt real. Whereas like a person, a person who's generally good, like Ex Machina was interesting because the guy was so conflicted and wasn't, you know, wanted to do good, but like was kind of a dick. Whereas like Luke Cage is not a dick. Luke Cage is a good guy. So, I just haven't seen anything interesting done with that story yet.
No, because nothing's really happened. It's still just, it's no different than Empire Strikes Back when Lando has to talk about running Cloud City.
Yeah.
There's like a bit, there's a quick beat in that movie where he talks about it. And then you can imagine like, oh, this guy doing that, that's funny. But that's Luke Cage is not as funny as Lando. And B, it's been going on a long time and nothing's, it just looks like, ugh, I got paperwork. That's been the entire thing.
Ugh, I don't know who the black guys too.
There's a lot of politics and history involved with that question that I'm not willing to get into.
It starts with the gangs of New York, the five boroughs they were. I don't know anything.
It's the 5 points. The boroughs may have been, it may as well have been other countries at that point.
John C. Reilly had a giant cross and Liam Neeson had the cross. Somebody hit somebody else with a cross and it was pretty badass. But the rest of that movie was pretty boring.
The head of the Dutch. Okay, first of all, that movie's 20 years old. It's failed genius, that movie. That movie, it doesn't come together for whatever reason, but it is a beautiful disaster. I saw it twice in the theater. I've seen it many times since then.
But at the end of the movie, it fast forwards to modern day New York City.
It's fine. I could look at it forever. I want to watch it right now just from talking about it. And I'm telling you, it doesn't work, but I don't care. This episode is brought to you by Macroverse. Check out their new comic series, Darkland, on Webtoons and the Macroverse app. Macroverse is proud to share their new comic book series in wide release, Darkland. Darkland is a delightfully twisted black comedy centered around the shifting alliances between the power players in Hell and the plans they have for Earth. A little bit of Game of Thrones mixed with Veep. It's twisted, funny, and provocative. It is created and written by Evan Shapiro with art by Frank Calico. Darkland is a digital comic with full episodes released bi-weekly on the Macroverse app in their proprietary Tap Story format, but is also released weekly in shorter episodes on Webtoons in their perpetual scroll version. The full series of Darkland will have a digital collectible release in elegant landscape format for the iPad and the web. It'll be coming in late March of 2023, which I believe is now-ish. It is followed by the trade paperback and collector's edition coming later in this year. There's many different ways to consume Darkland is what I'm hearing. Here's your chance to get involved. After the digital release in March, Macroverse will be working with fans to generate ideas for an anthology series set within the world of Darkland, which will be voted on by the community as to which will get greenlit into production as a separate release. Similar to what Macroverse did with their previous series, Dead Town, and their upcoming series called Bushidos. There's lots of cool stuff coming from Macroverse, so get on board now. Head over to their website at macroverse.com/darkland for more info, or go to Webtoons and search for Darkland. I hear about this this blue book.
Yeah, I talked about this in the first issue. This is a book from James Tinney IV, new Dark Horse imprint that he has, Onion something or other, Tiny Onion. Are you familiar with the Betty and Barney Hill story? I talked about it last episode, so I don't need to get into it again.
If it was heard, then it's fine.
It is the first sort of UFO abduction myth in American, I would say pop culture, but it was like supposedly a real historical event. I don't believe it went down the way that some of the people who believe in that stuff believe it went down, but this is sort of a retelling of it. You know, there were an interracial couple active in the civil rights movement in the early 60s who were driving back from vacation they lived in New Hampshire, and they were driving back to New Hampshire late at night. They didn't want to get a hotel because they were an interracial couple in the early 60s. So they were trying to get home, and then they saw a light in the sky, and then they felt like they lost a bunch of time. And Betty, the white wife of the couple, was already into sort of the UFO mythology that was burgeoning at that time. And she kind of pulled her husband along on this quest she had to prove that they'd been abducted. And they sort of became the first like popularized abductees.
It's crazy that I've never heard that. That seems like a thing I would have heard.
Well, now you've heard it. Welcome, right. Welcome. Welcome to the knowledge.
Thank you very much. I thought that Randy Quaid was the first person to get abducted by an alien.
He's back. So I have a weird thing where I think that like if aliens actually showed up, it would legit be the scariest thing ever, because if they were able to travel those distances successfully, we would not stand a chance, right?
I agree.
Like, if they wanted to destroy us, zombies, you know, you can hit a zombie with a baseball bat and it falls over. Vampires, like, I've always got garlic in the house, but like aliens, I can't do much.
I always assumed that if they were
Earth's
really
bacteria would infect the aliens.
Listen, there's a lot of movies we can do this about, but I'm going to try to push through.
sorry.
I always assume that either they would be so similar to us that they'd never get here because they're similar, you know, in the technology, the whatever, the physics is all too much, or they're so different from us
that they wouldn't care.
We wouldn't even like interact with each other.
Yeah, so you're kind of, I mean, Solaris is the movie, George Clooney movie, but based off a Russian novel that sort of posits the encountering an extraterrestrial intelligence. It would be so alien, like we can't communicate with lions, like, and lions are another mammal.
Right.
So like, how do we communicate with another intelligence? The third thought I always had is we evolved from, you know, monkeys and apes who were arboreal to some extent, so climbing trees. So I think we have a tendency to like look up about, you know, about stuff and like wonder about what's going on above. What if we had evolved from like a mole or an armadillo that's like a digger? Mm-hmm. Like maybe our entire maybe the space race would have been a race to the core with Aaron Eckhart and Stanley Tucci and Hilary Swank.
They don't make it.
So I always wonder if like,
I literally don't remember what movie that is. It's called The Core, right?
It's called The Core.
I did know they didn't make it. I knew that much.
But I always wonder like, what if all the alien species out there are more interested in digging into their own planet than they are on traveling to others? So, but I also think like, I've watched a lot of horror movies, and a lot of horror movies that even posit, you know, alien interactions, alien abductions, and like some of them have good moments, but I've never found one that like scratched the whatever psychological terror that I actually have when it comes to the idea of alien encounters and alien abductions. And I kind of hope this book would be that, just because I was so surprised by The Closet, his previous miniseries that kind of also had alien encounter vibes. And this seems to be more of a documentary style retelling of Betty and Barney Hill's experiences, fictionalized somewhat, but very much leaning on Betty, the wife's interpretation of events, which she kind of dove in headfirst to being a true believer and spent sort of the rest of her life using that sort of celebrity as her. I mean, she like essentially she was on the con circuit. She was like like the people that the B and C list actors we see at comic book convention signing headshots. She was that for the alien abduction community.
So does this work sort of like documentary, more or less?
It sort of seems like that's what he's trying to do, which I find a little less interesting than if he actually did it as a psychological horror book, which is what I was expecting. So I'm not hating this. I will keep reading it. I don't.
The way that you describe it makes me like it more. Are they grays? Are these the gray aliens?
This is the origin of that part of the American. So essentially there was like, this couple ends up, Barney, the husband who's black, ends up, they both end up undergoing hypnosis, and there are actually recordings that you can go listen to of his hypnosis of the event. And like, he was clearly disturbed by something, and listening to his hypnotic explanations of what happened is legitimately disturbing. Like, I'm getting goosebumps talking about it.
I don't think I can listen to that. That creepy.
It's really creepy. And so I want a creepy story. I don't want like a, well, and then Betty went outside and put a magnet on the car, and I'm like, okay, yeah, but like, I don't know that that actually happened. I don't know that that actually means anything. I don't know that it means aliens, but like, if these two people are terrified that in the midst of their struggle for civil rights, they were also being abducted by extraterrestrial beings, that's interesting.
I mean, it's hard enough being a black man in the 60s.
In New Hampshire. Live free or die, I say. So I don't know. It's not a bad book. It's incredibly well done. Michael Avon Oving is killing it on the art. And it's an easy read. It's a story I already know pretty well, so that might have something to do with it. And it's retelling the story in a way that I don't think is. I think it's selling the premise that they ended up believing that they were abducted by aliens, which I don't think is true. I think the universe probably has aliens, and I just don't think they're probing us. So this is not a bad book. It's actually quite interesting. It's just not exactly the book I thought I was getting when I started issue one and finished issue two.
Okay. Kind of want to read it.
You should. I would love to hear what you think of this as a person who wasn't familiar with the story before I gave you the quick little rundown that I did.
This was the short section, so I'm going to move along. She-Hulk 174, Rainbow
your,
Roll.
Your interview with Rainbow was fantastic, by the way.
I appreciate it. Thank you. That was great. I'm a lifelong fan of hers after talking to her then, because of the conversation we had afterwards that you didn't get to hear.
Well, it was the fact that you opened with, like, Rainbow, really? And she was like, no, my mom named me that. So, like, that to me was like, that's exactly the question I needed to answer first, and now I can focus.
Can I tell you something?
Sure.
Before we started, she was like, are you going to ask me about my name? I was like, yes, I was. And she's like, okay. And I was like, is that okay? And she's like, yes. And I was like, okay. And then we started recording, and that's what it was. But because at the beginning, the first thing I said to her was, am I supposed to call you Rainbow? And she's like, yes, that's my name. I was like, okay. But not in like a combative way. Anyway, yeah. Andre Genelay had been the alternate artist on her wonderful Runaways series. And I don't know if he's done one of these before, but he's not the series artist on this.
He's not.
And if all of this book was him drawing the Fight Club scene where
fantastic
Titania and She-Hulk and Luke Cage and the Thing just beat on each other to let out steam, it would have been great. I mean, it was great. I'm just saying, but that was literally enough. And I just thought it was super fun. We are lucky to get this book now. I'm enjoying the heck out of it. But as I've said, I'm now completely biased in favor of the writer. Although I would have been anyway, because I've really just enjoyed so much of her work in comics.
This is great. And I love, you know, I love how the relationship between her and Jonathan Hart has developed. I love that, you know, I love how much he enjoys cooking, even though his powers are back and he can't actually enjoy the food anymore. And like, I liked them trying to science out, like, is the food just deteriorating in my mouth because of all the radiation? Or like, why can't I eat? Like, they're now trying to solve the problem because now he's got a taste for it.
But that eating is a metaphor for humanity.
Oh, I know. The moment when they both kind of had to come to grips with what that aspect of his life and powers meant, and she puts her hand on his knee, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's sad.
It was real. I mean, as much as this book has like kind of danced around the edges of being a romance book, I find myself completely invested in that part of it.
I don't think it's dancing. I think it's off to the dance hall. I think they're firmly in that. But with some superhero action in the middle, just great, more great. I love that artist, and I was glad to see more of it.
This is another book. Jen Bartel's doing the covers for this book, who is someone I followed on Twitter because I liked her art before I stopped using Twitter, before she started getting good cover work. But I also really like I think this book has consistently really great covers.
Cover.
I mean, she's done the whole series, so go back and look through.
They've all been great, but this one was too.
Yeah, and it's a very modern style of cover where, like, it, unlike World's Finest, where this isn't giving anything away about the story until you start reading it and you go, oh, that's her doing the Fight Club. That's cool.
Well, it's like funny that you say it's a modern style of cover, because the covers of this are directly influenced by the early 90s Burn series and
true.
What those covers were like. So, and I mean, that's the one she loved, and that's what they were trying to emulate. So it's there. Doesn't matter. They're great graphic images, and that's the key. Why don't you talk for a little while, and I'm going to not interrupt you.
Go, go, Power Corner! It's Mighty Morphin Power Rangers number 106, story by Melissa Flores, illustrated by Simona Di Gianfelice, colored by Raul Angulo, and lettered by Ed Dukeshire from Once in Future fame. And this series has continued to just be really solid. I was a little worried when Ryan Parrott left. I think I've said that before, but it's continued to be great. And Josh, I'm not kidding. Laugh at me all you want. There is a final page reveal in this issue, and I legitimately gasped. I think anybody who can read between the lines of me being on the show and our conversations about this, I think gets that like part of the Power Rangers thing is a bit. But I've been reading the book long enough to annoy you and Connor that I'm now kind of invested.
I like that. I like that they won you over. But you were, I mean, like the center of this is like, this was your thing at a certain
when I was
point
a kid.
In your
yeah,
childhood,
yeah.
Right?
Absolutely. And
like,
I would say,
I'm going to be able to sit here and be like, "That's dumb." After I know every single thing about the G.I. Joe animated series, I mean,
no, but that's your right as an elder statesman of nerd culture, and I'm the young up and comer and young. And
what's funny because this really comes to the fact is when this came out, I was what 15, 16 or whatever,
too old. Yeah,
yeah, and I was, which of course at that age I would have gone, "That's stupid for babies," because I had no perspective whatsoever. But I don't want to ruin the bit, so.
And I would say that like where they're at, they're kind of like the characters that we're following now, and the Zords they're using, and the suits they have are like, I would say we are on the tail edge of when I kind of stopped watching the show. So if it keeps moving forward, we might soon reach a point where I don't know any of the characters or any of the Zords, and I might lose interest. But this book ended, spoiler warning for anybody who has not yet had a chance to read the issue, Zed gets a fucking morpher, and so now he is morphed into his own Zed version of being a ranger, and I gasped. I was like, holy shit, Zed's got a morpher. The Power Rangers might truly be fucked this time.
I just want to shove you in a locker right
These
now.
These rad teens with attitude, I call it ratitude, they might finally have met their match.
All right. Well, those are the books that we wanted to talk about, and this is the thing Connor says, so I don't get it wrong. But if you are a patron of any stripe, of any value, I'm not saying you're valuable or not,
you really
then,
are gonna do this wrong.
You can vote. I decided not to try to do it. You can vote on the patron pick, which is a book that we, your hosts, must read. We must read, we must discuss it, and we must rate it. And the pick this week was Dead Romans number one from Image Comics, Shadowline specifically. That's Jim Valentino's little corner, where he hires people all the time who I've never heard their names in any way. This story is by Fred Kennedy and Nick Marinkovic. Dead Romans is fairly literal in this sense.
I loved this. It would have been in my running for pick of the week if I'd had the pick.
Really?
Yeah, I thought this was fantastic.
I really, really wanted to like it.
And but you and I are both people who watched the show Rome from start to finish and still quote it from time to time at each other.
Multiple. I've watched through it multiple times.
I mean, Titus Pullover.
I liked Pullover. Pullover. Pullo. It's Pullo.
He's got a hoodie on.
They didn't have hoodies then.
I still see actors and stuff. I'm like, why do I know that person? It's always Rome. I got a little lost in it. I think that it looked very beautiful, but there was a bit where I had a real moment in this, and we can explain what it is in a second. But I mean, just at the base, it is a story of, I don't know exactly what year we're looking at, but the Roman legions are.
Oh, they said it was the 36th year of the reign of Augustus. Well, I'll explain Roman numerals to you after the show. It's fine.
Right. So does that mean 36 AD? No, because that's Jesus.
No. But,
like, Julius Caesar was like 1,000 years before.
No, he wasn't that much before Jesus. He was in like the tens of years before Jesus.
Okay. Well,
we're only doing the show in March. We should know.
Yeah, no, that's true. We just missed it. So we're in Germania. The Roman legions are trying to conquer the barbarian hordes
are my ancestors you're talking about, buddy.
Barbarian hordes. This is all a matter of perspective.
The Teutonic tribes who were rightly fighting for their independence against an oppressive empire. Thank you.
Sure, the Franks.
Hey, those are the Gauls. These are the Germans.
Whatever. You're all savages up there. Actually, I'm not a part of any of this. I'm just
going to say, Celts. Yeah, where are you coming from, Celt boy?
We're nowhere. And there's a story about some sort of Roman leader, and he is desperately in love with a slave girl who one of the other Roman soldiers owns. And I guess the guy's either a king, he's very high up. It's sort of unclear. And then we cut to some battle scenes, and I was completely lost in who was fighting and why, because it seemed like every single they were talking about fighting each other. Everyone they were talking about looked like a Roman.
Yep.
And the main character here, this one who's in love with the girl, that scene was really written beautifully.
Arminius.
He's indistinguishable in his armor from the other person they're talking about.
Right. And then he also seems to switch sides at some point, but yes. It seems like he was always on the other side, but we just didn't realize that. So yeah, there were storytelling issues. I still thought this was beautiful. Well, see,
there's a bit book. Where I was reading through it and I thought, wait, I'm lost. And I had two thoughts. As a person on this show, I thought, well, it's the patron pick. Do I go back and try to understand it? Or do I say this lost me and it's not my fault, but I want to give the benefit of the, I can screw up. So I gave the benefit of the doubt to the creators and I went back through and it didn't help at all.
I can see that.
It seems to be a historical story that has, as far as I can tell, no supernatural bent. It is about Romans, you know, going into mainland Europe and conquering, and that is my fucking jam. And it is right? Beautiful. It is.
It's really
absolutely gorgeous. However, I believe that the stylism and the beauty of the art is not helping tell the story, and
there have been books like that in my comic book reading life that like I have fond memories for, and I could not tell you I couldn't tell you anything about what they were about. So like there was this series from the mid 2000s called Rakedo. Do you remember what I'm talking
familiar.
About?
But, I
yeah,
mean,
like, but like it won, like it was nominated for multiple Eisner Awards, and it was gorgeous, and I had no clue what was going on ever. But I still just kind of drank it in because I was like, I don't know, but I also don't care because I'm just enjoying the art and soaking it in. Yeah.
And I guess that's okay, but to me, that's a failure of the form. And since I don't know who these people are,
right? That's the elephant in the room.
That this, you know, there's somebody is new at this. Like there's skill here. There's clearly skill here.
Yeah, there's something amateur about the effort if we as experienced readers are having a hard time understanding the story being told.
Right. And there is a thing where sometimes you need to give up some of that aesthetic beauty in service of storytelling. If your beauty is making it harder to read and understand, then you're doing it for no reason. And that's what got me here. And so I really, really wanted to like it, and I did like parts of it, but ultimately, I don't know what happened. I don't know who I'm looking at. It looks cool, but it's like looking at paintings. Like, there's a story in there, but I may as well be making it up.
Well, was the
girl captured? Was she killed?
No.
There was a page here where, so here, this is a really good example.
So this first scene is the guy and the woman are in their love nest, and he's professing all this stuff to her. And then she's dressed, and then they're having sex. But there's a sort of, are they on this train cart, or is that happening at a different time? Then the carriage is attacked by somebody, and it says Germans. And then she falls, like, none of that. Like, you can't, if you go through this and look at it, it doesn't make sense. We talked about the flashback in Punisher earlier and how they found a way to denote that and say that it was happening. There's nothing here for this time jump. I think it time jumps. Like, I think it does too. It needed somebody to be like, none of this is fucking clear. Before you digitally paint this and make it absolutely beautifully rendered, you got to work on your layouts. You have to tell the story because you're not doing it. The main character and then the other guy who owns the woman cannot look exactly alike. They can't look exactly alike without their armor. They can't look exactly alike with their armor. And I know right now that if you're the artist or whatever and you're listening to this, you're like, they don't look the same. They fucking well do, because I can't tell the difference. And I read a lot of comic books. And I didn't read it lazily. I'm annoyed because I really want to like it. Can you tell?
And I did like it. And can I make one other point?
Please.
I would like to get back I would like to bring back the style of greeting each other with hail. I would like to join this podcast and say, "Hail, Josh Flanagan."
Salve, Ryan.
I just think it's just a fun way to say hello to somebody.
Well, yeah, but eventually it morphs into Heil, and I'm not doing that.
Well, it is there in Germany.
There you go.
All right. So I guess maybe I think I'm more fascinated by the question, are you sticking with it, than I am your ratings right now, if I'm being honest.
All right, so I'll start with that.
Do you give them a second issue to make right on some of their mistakes?
Yeah, I mean, theoretically they should get better. And I would point to the Texas book. Why can't I remember anything
today? Texas Blood.
That Texas Blood, you know, a little shaky at first, and then it came together into one of my favorite books.
Can I tell you that Connor confused me? I'm going to blame Connor on this. I kept looking for a book called Two Dead Romans, because this was ahead by two votes on the patron voting.
That's a great title. That's a better title than One.
Well, because I was also thinking about Kieran Gillen did that series 3. Yeah. That was like sort of his take on 300. It was great. It was great. So I was kind of associating, I think I was associating Greco-Roman down to earth stories. I think I associate them with numbers because you have 300, you have 3. So I was like, okay, Two Dead Romans. We're working our way towards one.
Like a historical comedy, and I would 100% be down with that.
It sounds like something from Life of Brian.
Yeah. Oh, it is.
What have the Romans done for us? Aqueducts.
Well, of course they've done the aqueducts, but after that, what have they done?
I'm also sticking with this. I really enjoyed it, and I think some of the storytelling issues, I had them as well. They didn't get under my skin to the same extent, and so I'm looking forward to seeing if I can suss out more of what's going on in issue 2 and beyond.
I'm trying to enjoy you. This is like one of those shows that is a great show, but it's too fucking dark and you can't tell what's going on. It's an HBO show. So we need to give it a number, because that is the way of things around here.
This is the way. I'm giving it a 4.
2.5.
Yeah.
Like they lose half for the inability to tell a story, but they get the other half for being interesting enough and you know, aesthetically beautiful enough, storytelling aside, that it's a gorgeous book. They just gotta,
my number might be a little artificially inflated because I just had a good time reading comics this week.
So that's just fair. Feeling that's good absolutely
about
fair.
I've had a really stressful like 2-ish plus years, not weeks, at work. So I just really needed to like lie down on the couch after having some dinner and just sip a little whiskey and read my comics. And I just really enjoyed most of my books this week. There were a lot of books that didn't make the list.
I always have this idea in my head that when you're going to do this show, we're just forcing you to frog march through comics.
No,
feels like that some week.
I could have talked about Deceased. I could have talked about Joe Fixit. I could have talked about Nightwing. Like, I just had a good time reading comics.
Right. It was good. I'm glad. I did too. I enjoyed my books this week. I finally figured out a system so that I don't necessarily have to mainline them all in one night.
It's good.
Somewhat to the benefit of my position. But I need to.
If you like hearing us talk about comics, you might also like becoming a patron at patreon.com/ifanboy, where you can directly support the show. We unlock all kinds of different content. It gives us all more to do and more to talk about. Revamped Patreon part one, new stretch goals. They're getting rid of stretch goals, so we'll be working on implementing new stretch goals. I have nothing to do with that process, so leave. Don't come to me with your suggestions, people. Ifanboy.threadless.com is where you can get 12 t-shirt designs and more, including the newest design, Gosh. Of which there was a fair bit this week, even though we didn't refer to it directly. Direct support can go to ifanboy.com/support, where you can donate through PayPal, throw some coins in the tip jar, and then you can also buy things at ifanboy.com/Amazon, as well as bookshop.org, which is a website that supports independent booksellers, local bookstores, the places you ought to be supporting. They're probably not registered as nonprofits, but they might not be making one if we don't support them through places like bookshop.org. But maybe, you know, you might have a superpower where you can make a profit as a nonprofit. And if you had such a power, it might be bestowed upon you in the segment that is coming up, where every week we thank a patron who has supported us at the $5 or higher level at patreon.com/ifanboy by giving them a quote unquote dumb, end quotes, superpower. And this week, Josh is going to bestow the power.
Michael. Here we go. Odajewski.
I love that.
That's how I'm going to pronounce it.
That was great.
I think I practiced it when I wrote it down. I was like, and then I forgot. All right, ready? This is going to sound mundane, but Michael gets all of his work done with no problems, distractions, or anxiety, and then he gets on with his life.
Wait, say that one more time. That was so profound, I lost the thread of it.
He gets all of his work done. Like, he's got a bunch of work to do. He does all of it. There's no real problem. He doesn't get distracted. He doesn't feel anxious about whether it's good or not. He just does his work with the skill that he has, and then he gets on with his life.
There was a power I gave out early in my power giving period that was like, whenever that person writes an email, they're like, the content intention of the email is understood with no further questions. And I feel like these two guys, if they teamed up... If they teamed up, they would be unstoppable.
Yeah.
That's an incredible power. Because have you read any of, there's scientists, not me, but other scientists have studied the fact that like we have a sort of a set amount of willpower every day. Uh-huh. It's sort of like if at the end of the day, a Jedi couldn't quite force pull something across the room because they're a little tired at the end of the day.
Sure.
There's like a set amount of willpower we all have, but it sounds like Michael is able to tap into a source of willpower external to his own internal willpower and get all the stuff done.
He just has enough, and he's not wasting that energy on anything else. What he does is he goes, oh, this is my job. I have to do these things, and then does them. So there's his power. We have one question that we're going to do. It's probably from our most prolific and maybe best question writer, Ken from the Great White North.
I think of questions to send to you guys, and I'm like, that's dumb. I shouldn't send. Should I send any questions when I think of them? Is that weird?
You have to send them as someone else.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah, I can't know it's from you.
No, it's fair. That's an excellent.
I wouldn't know at the end because it'd be like Steve from Cincinnati writes in. Think of the tree sloth, which comes back as like it has an extra paragraph or two about unrelated evolutionary problems
with a large addendum of like, and like considering chili styles, I think there's a case to be made for Cincinnati style chili.
Yeah.
While unconventional in many respects, I think, you know, okay, yeah, I see your point. Thank you for that. Thank you for that advice.
I could suss that out.
I will forward my questions through a third party from now on.
Ken asks, what writer or artist would you say is the biggest reason you got into comics and why? Whether it was a certain issue, a particular storyline, etc. Mine was Jim Aparo. Now, I've talked about this for me before. I always say that Amazing Spider-Man 315, 16, the Todd McFarlane era was a real mindfuck for me. You know, this is totally a deal. There was also, I'm saying it quickly so I get to give you room for it.
Sure.
John Buscema on How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way was a really big deal because I read that thing all the time and it taught me how to sort of appreciate the art a little bit. So when it came back, I came to reading comics for real the first time. John Buscema was the artist on Chris Claremont's Wolverine series, which is one of the first things I also read. And so that was my like, oh, I recognize this name, and I learned about his drawing. So that pulled me in. And then actually at the same time, Jim Aparo was on Batman, which is one of the other things I started reading at that point. And then John Byrne in that same sort of era. That would be mine. And they were all artists. They weren't writers. I didn't really learn the writers until a little later.
Yeah. And like I read comics as a very little kid, like literally whatever, you know, there was, I think I've said this on the show before, but the bookstore I used to go to a lot as a kid had like a paper bag, you know, it's got 6 or 7 comics in it and it's $3 and you buy it and you get whatever you get. And so like I got these random smatterings of comics and I read them over and over again, but like I was not aware of who was writing them or who was drawing them. I think it was also Todd McFarlane era Spider-Man, because I'm a little younger than you. When I was old enough to actually recognize that there was like a distinct writer, a distinct artist, and distinct styles of those two things was closer to high school. Mm-hmm. And so my answer is actually pretty clear on this. It's Brian Michael Bendis on Ultimate Spider-Man and Mark Miller doing Superman Red Son. Huh. Those are the two books that got me into reading comics regularly in the fashion that I have not ever quit since up to, right, you know, today.
So that's interesting, because that would sort of be like when I became a more informed reader, which would have been more like towards the end of my college, you know, like what I was just talking about. I was about 11, you know, and I read comics for a couple of years and then got out for a while and then met Connor and started again. I mean, then we're talking about Grant Morrison, Mark Waid, Kurt Busiek.
I was with Ron, who at Isotope when they were doing, there was a Mark Miller Tony Harris event they did, because remember that book? Yeah. They did that one issue we got, and then a television or movie deal got sold, and then we never saw either the book nor the adaptation ever again. It was like Soldiers of Superpowers or something. I don't remember the name of it. I met them both in an event. I like Tony Harris fine, but you know, Mark Miller was who I was really excited to meet. And like, I definitely had one of those moments of like Ron saying like, Ryan, you're shaking his hand too long. Because I was telling him all about how like, mm-hmm, you know, you're the reason I still read comics today. And Superman Red Son was, you know, I had the moment where I couldn't. I've met Bendis too, and that did not happen with Bendis.
Sure.
but you know, and I've also met Mark Bagley, and super didn't happen with Mark Bagley because, well, I'll tell you about that offline.
He never stopped drawing.
No, he did not. So I think we talked to the same Mark Bagley for sure. Mm-hmm. But And Dave Johnson, who did the Reverend Dave Johnson, who did Superman Red Son, I've actually hung out with him socially and didn't geek out over him, but he's also an awesome dude, artist. And
like, he's amazing. He's a legend.
Deserving of the title of Reverend, in my opinion. Yeah. So yeah, those are the two series on the Marvel side and the DC side that got me back into reading comics regularly. And I would not have been able to tell you for probably the first 100 issues of Ultimate Spider-Man that it was written by a guy named Brian Michael Bendis. But I remember, you know, Marvel's website in the early days had some like very, you know, pieced together e-reader functionality where I was able to read like the first couple issues of Ultimate Spider-Man on my computer using my, you know, dial-up modem or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then I went to the local Books-A-Million, which was our bookstore that we had in town, and found a collected edition of like, oh my gosh, this is the first like 6 issues of that. That's amazing. And I bought that, and then I was off to the races.
If you would like to write in and send us a message, that's contact@ifanboy.com. If it's a Media Splode question for our other show, which is a non-comic show, you should put Media Splode in the subject so that we know to separate it from those things. If you're Ryan, you're going to have to create a new account somewhere else to send us questions, but I feel like we're going to know. Because if it's a good question, that means it's going to involve your thought process, and you have a very unique thought process.
Thank you.
There's a lot of shows going on right now. I don't know if I have this order right, but here's what you can look for. This past week, there was a show on Shazam, Fury of the Gods. I volunteered myself to be on that show, only to find out it had already been recorded. But I did see the film, and since I'm not on that show, I'll tell you this. I enjoyed it. I don't think it was great, but I really had a fun time seeing it. I was like, oh, superheroes. This is great. It's also the only time that DC has put together 2 movies in a row that were passable, that were related to one another.
Wow. Shots fired.
I mean, you could say Batman Begins and The Dark Knight Returns, but that's a different thing, I think.
No, that's not part of the DCEU.
You can find my Talksplode with Ryan North.
Hey, I know that guy.
Yeah, Ryan North. Actually, yeah, you've had him on your show.
Multiple times I've met him in person. He's taller than me, which is upsetting. Sure. But he's from Canada, so I guess that makes sense. Can I have a quick Ryan North thing?
Okay.
First of all, he's Manly Ryan. We have a shared group of friends who have so many Ryans in their lives that they name all the different Ryans.
Sure.
Also, it didn't come up in your interview, but I would encourage everyone who's still on Twitter or has a Twitter account to look up the time that Ryan North fell in a hole and could not get out and tweeted his way through the saga, because it's frankly, it's one of the greatest stories ever told.
I did read through that before I talked to him, but I did not bring it up because it was not germane to the situation.
That was also a great conversation, but Ryan North's also a delightful person, so it's hard not to have a good conversation with him.
He was, and I say this with respect to everybody else I've ever talked to, I was like, oh, he's much more intelligent than I am. And that doesn't happen a ton.
But he's so nice.
He's totally nice. And he was really nice. But I was like, oh, I'm struggling to keep up with him. Like, in a good way.
He's got a master's in computational linguistics.
Yeah, no, I was like, oh, boy. Normally I can charm my way through anything. But I was like, I really have to pay attention here. There is a media splode that came out recently where we talked about The Last of Us and the first season of Star Wars Andor. We are looking forward to Booksplode with Kingdom Come is coming out. I've almost finished reading it. We'll be recording it this week, and so it should be out this coming week. There is a animated show or movie called Batman: The Doom That Came to Gotham that may be coming out at some point soon. As I said, Connor,
it's a sequel to the Gotham by Gaslight.
Oh, cool. Connor's on the work trip from hell, so when he gets back to it, he's going to have to spend a little time getting up. But that'll be literally as soon as it can be done. You'll have that in your hot little hands. Take us out.
You can find our library of over 1,200, that's right, count them up, 1,200 shows and counting over at ifanboy.com or wherever podcasts are sold for money and profit. Follow us at ifanboycomics on Instagram to find out what the pick of the week is before the show comes out, and sometimes for the latest best of the week in panels, which is super fun. Little segment that Connor mostly does that I wish
not
I contributed
mostly
more to. Follow us individually. I am at CS Kilpatrick on Instagram, but I'm also at Ryan Haupt on Instagram. A lot of people don't know I run Connor's Instagram.
Yeah.
And Josh is at J.A. Flanagan on Instagram. So that's fun too.
I have a boo-boo. That's what was on my Instagram today. You know what I did? I got a new serrated knife.
Ooh,
because
fun.
The good folks at Wusthof have a lifetime warranty, and mine chipped off, so I got a new one in.
Oh, you mean the Germans that you were denigrating earlier in the show?
Listen, there's two sides to every coin. I decided it would be a good idea to cut a clove of garlic in half without using a cutting board. Just
with a serrated knife?
It was right there, and I just needed to cut it in half, and it wasn't like a big deal, and that fucker dug in. And it dug in hard, and it hurts right now. I spent a long time trying to button the sleeve of my shirt today.
That's like what happened on Clarkson's Farm Season 2, the thing that we're also here to discuss.
I did reference that. You can subscribe to youtube.com/ifanboy. You're going to find all of our old video shows there. We post this show there every week. You can subscribe to that if you want to. I could care less. Please consider
hit that subscribe button. Nope. Ring that bell.
Please consider writing us a review or leaving a star rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whatever those profit and or nonprofit podcasts, most nonprofit. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Ryan, for coming here. Last one who says their name, but I'm going to be Josh, and that leaves one person.
I guess that would make me Ryan.
Yep.
And we'll see you next week. Drive fast and take chances.
Yes.
Yes.
In the world. Who rules the day? Who rules the night? Put back your bags, take up your sight. I said, this world wasn't meant for us both.